Blog Talk Radio.
Just a step, cried the sad man. Take a look down at the madman. Theater king's on. Silver wings fly beyond reason. From the flight of the seagull come the spread claws of the eagle. Only fear breaks the silence as we all kneel, pray for guidance. We'll be right back.
Freaky Darlings, and welcome to Late Night Poets at the Midnight Show, where you get to take a walk on the wild side. If you're into the likes of Ginsberg, Bukowski, Ferlinghetti, Kerouac, and Morrison, then you are on the right night. But please check out our other After Midnight shows. Friday's a split between Crawling into the Darkness with Pam and Break On Through. Join Aphasiana and Babbler as they teach you the fine art of being part sinner, part saint. And Mondays, a split between The Hearts of L&P with Victoria and Black Lace Diaries with Mr. M and Mistress Frost. And these shows are designed so you can color outside the lines with rich raw emotions tinged with colloquial language, thereby pushing the envelope to expression and opening up new avenues of thought and voice. Now, pull up a chair, relax, and open your mind. I'm Rex, my co-host Pam Ray, and I can't wait to get into and read your words. Good evening, Pam. What's doing? You mutating? Hello,
well,
Pam?
Let me... Yes, hello, Rex. And yes, I was mutating. I was responding to you with some brilliant verbal quip. No, actually, I really wasn't. I was telling you that I had a wonderful day. I went for a walk, watched some TV, made myself a margarita or two, but I didn't have any tequila, so I used vodka. But anyways, nice night tonight, called into the earlier show, you know, and enjoyed some slightly warmer weather for this area. And how about you? How was your day?
Just another nice day, 70 degrees.
Oh, nice. Nice. I am very envious of that. But I still enjoyed my 35 or 40 degree weather. I mean, that was nice, but it definitely wasn't 70. But, yeah, man, things must be growing there very nicely.
They will be.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I still need to get my tomato and pepper plants seeds planted. I probably, you know, I kind of regret doing that. That was a bit of an impulse buy, you know. I probably should have waited a while and just gotten the actual, like, baby plants, rather than start completely by seed. But anyway, lesson learned, and hopefully something good will come out of it. So anyways, well, we have a great lineup tonight. A lot of people were inspired, and I'm looking forward to tonight's poetry. And just to let you know, I have brought Randy on. So welcome, Randy. Glad you could join us.
Hello. How are you folks?
Hey, Randy. How you doing?
Good. Very good. Thank you.
Excellent. All right.
Good. Yeah,
we're going to kick in the gears and move it on up.
Absolutely. 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 And Randy, I put your poem up. Go ahead and give it a read for us, please.
All right. My poem was based on prompt number two. If you can talk brilliantly about a problem, it can create the consoling illusion that it has been mastered. Prompt that I made this poem, which is talk is cheap. Many a grand idea has been built upon talk. Experts who have never walked the walk become the headline with their gift of gab. Selling a plan for what people need to have. If persuasive enough, they'll seal that deal. Pushing a project that may be a bit unreal, their only value is in the well-spoken word, moving the gullible like a leaderless herd. Politicians making promises by the score, equality, but there remains too many poor, housing, homeless continue on the street, hunger, kids still don't have enough to eat. St. Jude's Hospital, built by Danny Thomas, done by hard work, not an empty promise. Greatness, unknown to a bloviating creep, built upon work, proving idle talk is cheap. End poem.
Great read, Randy. Thank you very much. And Pam, why don't we kick it off with you, too?
Absolutely. Great read there, Randy. I like that you went with the title and the whole message of that talk is cheap. You know, it's all about action, you know, showing. You can talk all you want about how you care, but until you put that caring into action, it means absolutely nothing. And this is a great write all the way through, but I really like the lines that say their only value is in the well-spoken word, moving the gullible like a leaderless herd. And then that's the second and third the third and fourth stanzas I particularly like, in the idea that the politicians always making these empty promises, always talking about how they're going to help the homeless, they're going to house the homeless, and then you give us, an example of something that gets done by somebody through hard work, I like that built upon work, proving idle talk is cheap. You know, it's one thing to say something's important to you. It's one thing to voice a thought, an opinion, and say, this is a cause I really care for. But if you're not putting some action behind those words, then you're looking for nothing more than the votes of the gullible. So just an excellent write and very well done.
Thanks, Pam.
Well said, Pam. Thank you. Randy, I love that pick. That is pretty cool. The thought of all those singularities looking the same, being talked down to by one who is of different reference and offers a higher power. I like that picture. And like Pam just iterated, I do like the same thoughts that roll through this, the emptiness in the reveal of language spoken. Boy, does this walk in today's spirit where things are being pounded by a number of edifices all over the board just to get you to walk a particular narrative and talk the same talk, because you know what? It's all about generating the narrative and pushing the masses towards a singularity of belief. And I like the back end of this. We hit the thought with Danny Thomas and St. Jude's, but also greatness unknown to a bloviating creep, built upon work, proving idle talk is cheap. Boy, there's a whole lot of truth in that. It reminded me of something I just saw. Maxine Waters was just did it a few days ago, and she was telling a bunch of people to go home. And she was so oblivious to the fact the reason they were there in the first place was they needed help because they had no homes to go to. And that just proves the point. People who sit so long in a singularity and enjoy what they have do not give a rat's hairy hind ass about anything anybody else below their rank and file care about. They're oblivious to real life problems.
That's so true. Yeah. Thanks, Rex. Most politicians, and the ones that nowadays, when you look at so many of them that have been there for 20, 30, 40 years, they are so insulated from reality and removed from the common folks that they're supposed to be representing, that comments like that are all too common, unfortunately, coming from politicians who, like you said, the only thing they care about is getting reelected. And it's a shame because it hurts everyone else. But, yeah, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. All right, Pam, what you got, Nugget?
All right. Up next, we have Lights, Camera, Kubrick by Bill Schiller. And it goes like this. Filmer of a feigned moon landing, cinematography shining as a full metal jacket, classic as a Barry Lyndon history, pioneering astronaut on an odyssey, a strange man to love when eyes are not wide open, devilish as Lolita, braver than Spartacus, referred to by rivals as genius of a jerk, redefining screen time like an orange clockwork. End poem.
Great read, Pam. Thank you very much. All right, Randy, why don't we start with you? What'd you think?
Well, this is a pretty interesting how Bill interwove a bunch of Coleridge work throughout the poem and made it work very well. Good read, Pam, and I like the classic as a Barry Lyndon history, pioneering astronaut on an odyssey, strange man to love when eyes are not wide open, devilish as Lolita, braver than Spartacus. I mean, each line promotes a great movie that he was involved in, Stanley Kubrick, and it's quite a list, and it was a very well-written poem, and I really liked it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Randy. And Pam, how about you?
Yeah, I really liked this. I thought, you know, other than, you know, obviously starting first with Randy, that this was a good way to kick off the show because it pays tribute to Kubrick. And I like what Randy had to say, and I agree with him. It was really clever the way that Bill here used the titles of movies that were directed by Stanley Kubrick within the right to pay tribute to him, to, you know, give us an idea of his personality. I really particularly like A Strange Man to Love When Eyes Are Not Wide Open, and then referred to by rivals as Genius of a Jerk, redefining screen time like an orange clockwork. There's actually this really fascinating video about Stanley Kubrick's use of color in cinematography, and another one on his other ones on his methods of directing. So just a really just great, clever write and very well done.
Absolutely. I remember way back in the day, as a class outing, we actually got to go and see a 2001 A Space Odyssey. Damn, going back a long way. But there's two lines.
Wow.
I really like in this. The next one down, A Strange Man to Love When Eyes Are Not Wide Open. Kind of a backhanded reference to Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Love the Bomb. Yeah. And then the back end, redefining screen time like an orange clockwork. That was another clever closing, offering that was a very, very strange film way back in the day as well. Well done, Bill. Thank you very much for this.
Yeah, there are a lot of good movies listed there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's, 2001 came out, what, 68? His use of color in depicting the passage of travel in space was quite groundbreaking. Nobody had seen anything like it.
Full Metal Jacket was a pretty impactful movie.
Yes.
Like all Vietnam movies, of course, there wasn't a ton of reality involved, but there were some moments there that you could relate to. I mean, I'm a Vietnam vet, so those movies always interest me. And despite the fact that they generally that close to reality, but it was very, very powerful movie and kind of a sad movie. And
so it was Deer Hunter had that very same effect, running along the same lines of what happened afterwards.
Yep, very good. Yeah.
So question for you, Randy.
Mm-hmm.
as a veteran, which Vietnam movie, well, like which movie do you feel most realistically portrays the experience of the Vietnam War?
Well, the one that that is closest to me, because I was on riverboats when I was over there, is Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
Although it had its moments of reality, but for the most part, it was pretty far out. But that one was a one that personally was touching to me. And there were aspects of that. There were a couple of scenes there in the river where they started catching fire from the bank of the river. And that were pretty realistic. It's pretty close. Sometimes you were getting shot at by people that you could have hit with a rock. So it gets pretty crazy in a hurry.
Oh, wow. I can only imagine. Well, thank you. Thank you. I was just curious. And all right, are we ready to go to the next one, Rex?
Sure.
All right. Well, up next we have Lost and Found by Sleeping Lion. And Rex, will you please give that a read for us?
Lost and Found by Sleeping Lion. My dearest self, I see your face residing in a state of grace, and though I long to come to you, there still are things that I must do. I know perfection is your way, and I would give the world to stay within the garden of your mind. The simple truth of being kind is all you ask of me today, but there are demons I would slay before I ever dare come close enough to you compare. And so I labor on this earth, I sow, I reap, I find my worth. I fight with dragons and I burn. It is the only way to learn. But when the dross is burnt away, perhaps at last I'll come and stay. This earth at last I'll leave behind and live forever in your mind. The dragon's breath will purify the love I have, and like a sty, I'll leave this carnal house of clay and know I am the way. And boom. All right, Pam, you got to go first.
All right. Well, first of all, wonderful read there, Rex. This is just a beautiful spiritual write, and I like how the general message is one of knowing that you have a purpose still to be fulfilled on this earth, you know, and I like how he brings in the battles that we fight and, you know, and so I labor on this earth, I sow, I reap, I find my worth, I fight with dragons and I burn, it is the only way to learn. For when the dross is burnt away, perhaps at last I'll come and stay, you know. And then just a really nice rhyme and flow, and, you know, I like that he used the I am in capitals as a nod towards the Godhead and, you know, Christ and the great I am. And then I also like the reference of leaving the house of clay, you know, leaving the body behind and becoming spiritual, a spirit, you know, and just really nice rhyme and flow, a very positive and uplifting message. And another wonderful phrase was within the garden of your mind. That is beautiful. And very well done.
Well said, Pam. Thank you. And Randy, how about you?
Yeah, I agree with everything Pam said, and the verses that she read struck me as well. But you know, it's a really deep and wonderful reflection, inner look within the person. And my dearest self, I see your face residing in a state of grace, and though I long to come to you, there still are things I must do. I mean, you know, and then it goes on, I know perfection is your way. It, you know, we have thoughts and we have dreams, we have visions of what we hope to become, we don't always meet those because we have demons to battle and things like that. So it's just really, I thought it was really a powerful and wonderful, well-written poem, and it had nice rhyme to it, and it told a great story throughout. So I was really taken.
Wow. That's a great comment there, Andy. Thank you. And I agree. That reflection does hit itself in that opening stanza with my dearest self, I see your face residing in a state of grace. There's that understanding of Christ in the moment being part of the equation, that you are part of that itself, the garden of your mind, another reflection of that again, the demons you hit upon. And that's what, so I labor on this earth. That's exactly a reference to Christ, that laboring to bring about that message, so to speak, the fight with dragons that I burn. Literal thoughts to putting up with the, not putting up with, taking those trials and tribulations as that offering of self in the moment, and kind of a purification in the in that thought of taking the enduring those trials and tribulations as a way of cleansing before that risen motif it welcomes you home, so to speak, and that I am the way. It is that offering with the understanding that you cannot deny yourself that which is before you get that which really is. So, great comments, you see. And I'm back to your way, Pam.
Great comment there, Rex. I really liked how you mentioned that you can't walk away basically from what is. You know, you can't go to what is to be until you take care of what is. And so nicely said there. And up next we have...
You can't pay to get in. You've got to earn your way to get in.
Yeah. Yep. Well said there. And up next we have The Real Truth by Stelina. And Randy, I know you have to go soon, but if you could give that a read for us, it's a shorty, I'd really appreciate it.
Sure, no problem. Okay, this is by Stelina, The Real Truth. Thought is but a fleeting moment, changeable as the seasons, a fickle and fickle as Lady Luck. It can be irresistible, potent, all-consuming, at least for a while, seducing and reassuring till doubt shows up uninvited. For the mind is a warlock, leading threads of persuasion to devilishly dupe us with false hope. Then begins a duel as the nemesis, feeling, cast down the gauntlet to thought who, in his bravado and arrogance, accepts feeling, a formidable foe, possesses our inner psyche with inexplicable instinct and victorious voice truth in poem.
Great read, Randy. Thank you very much. All right, Pam, what you got?
I really liked this. It had a really nice flow to it. Great read there, Randy. I really like the lines, the beginning. Thought is but a fleeting moment, changeable as the seasons and fickle as Lady Luck. I like the whole idea of personifying the feelings, the hope, you know, feelings. It kind of reminds me of the battle between the mind and the heart, between the logic and the emotion. I also really like, for the mind is a warlock weaving threads of persuasion, devilishly dupe us with false hope. It's amazing how we can become our own worst enemies by playing scenarios over and over again in our head until we convince ourselves that that which is not the truth is. And sometimes it becomes so difficult for the voice of reason to be victorious, as she says, our inner psyche with inexplicable instinct, the victorious voice of truth. So beautifully written and very well done.
Well, thank you, Pam. And Randy, you got to read that. How about you?
I wouldn't want to say why is this, Pam. You know, it's amazing the mind games that we go through as human beings, and where our thoughts and imagination, emotions and feelings take us. And it's a roller coaster ride. And our feelings quite often contradict what our mind tells us should be common sense. So we're always caught in a flux between feelings and emotion and reasonable thought. And it's that constant battle that goes on within us. And it's hard sometimes to overcome it. Sometimes our mind and reason wins, and sometimes we allow ourselves to be ruled by our emotions. And I thought this poem kind of laid that out in a thoughtful way. So,
another great thought there, Randy. Thank you very much. And yeah, I too hit on that thought of logic and emotion that rolls in here, but she rolled this out as a thought between men and women. So it adds a little bit more and maybe interaction between those two angles, which was played out nicely. Excellent, Stelina. Thank you very much. All right, Pam, we're back to you.
All right. Up next we have Follower by Gerald E. Green, and we have a recording for that. So, here we go.
Welcome to Gerald Green Poetry. Follower, written and read by Gerald Green. You read her poetry expecting to be led, a journey on a road you've never seen, with destination full of mystery. You think you're safe, can close the book at any time and be dismissed. But don't be fooled. She's got you hooked. You can't undo what's done. You might as well admit how expectations bow before the poet's pen, bend with phrases, moods, and symbols of desire. Following can be a wondrous thing for those who laze in stagnant pools of energy, waiting for their sun to rise. Let the rhymes stick to wrinkled fabric, dog hair on the rug of life, twisting your reality without concern. Dim your light when eyelids close, allowing night to penetrate and push new thoughts beyond the berm. Days go by, and when the seeds begin to sprout and shoots rise silently, new thoughts and changed opinions slowly grow. This change occurs from deepness and conviction of credentialed personage, as if it is original, not planted by the subtlety of poetry. The hazy mirror falls in line, reflects a confidence reserved for one who senses all is well, regardless of reality. You raise your chin and face the world as if you have the power of an autocrat and swagger to your next appointment with dispatch.
Great.
Visit
read,
YouTube
Gerald, and
for more Gerald Green poetry.
Oh, wasn't expecting that. Great read, Gerald. Thank you very much for the SoundCloud. It is truly appreciated. All right, Pam, what you think?
Yeah, he always puts that now at the end of his recordings. But I thought that was, of course, a wonderful read. I'm always thankful to anyone who makes recordings for us.
It's
funny, isn't it? He actually used the same style of image as Randy did for his poem. I mean, like, not the same image, but like the one person with red and the others in white.
Yeah, I like that picture. It's the same thing, except you got the red footprints with the grays following behind.
Yep, exactly. I really like how he gives a nod towards the idea of following other poets, but also following in general. And what I like is that his approach to this topic isn't one of complete negativity, but isn't one of, like, it doesn't completely condemn, but it doesn't completely say, yes, it's okay. You know, if it says, because it does say, you know, following can be a wondrous thing for those who laze in stagnant pools of energy waiting for their sun to rise. Let the rhyme stick to wrinkled fabric, dog hair on the rug of life, twisting your reality without concern. So there's that kind of bite to it. I like this change occurs from deepness and conviction of credentialed personage as if it is original, not planted by the subtlety of poetry. I like those lines and the whole idea of being guided by someone else's thoughts, but putting them into your own actions. I like the use of dim your light when eyelids close, allowing night to penetrate and push new thoughts beyond the berm. I thought there was a really nice flow to those lines, and I really like that whole idea of, you know, like, you don't have to pay attention to what everyone else is doing. You can look inside yourself to find an answer. So just a really thought-provoking write and very well done.
Great story, Sam. Part of this had me thinking of a JFK speech from almost 60 years ago when he offered up, when power leads men towards arrogance, poetry reminds them of his limitations. When power narrows the areas of man's concern, poetry reminds him of the richness and diversity of his existence. When power corrupts, poetry cleanses. For art establishes the basic human truth, which must serve as the touchstone of our judgment. And it's on that sort of, you read a poetry expecting to be led. And the idea is people do follow people. But the understanding that should come with that, he hits that. Let the rhyme stick to wrinkled fabric, dog hair on the road of life, twisting your alley without concern. Dim your light when eyelids close, allowing night to penetrate, pushing it towards beyond the berm. The idea is not just following the thoughts itself, but expounding upon that as to enlighten oneself rather than fall within that line of following someone ad hoc without the adherence to self itself. To oneself. And we're so glad to stand this hit on that sort of the hazy mirror falls in line, reflects the confidence reserved for one who senses all is well, regardless of reality. You raise your chin and face the world as if you have the power of an autocrat, and you swagger to your next appointment with dispatch. All right, that last one hits on the notion of, yes, you should have that that confidence, but you don't disregard reality in the process, because if you do, you're doomed to failure within that moment. Good done, General. All right. What we got next?
All right. Up next, we have to do... The Average of Life by Garanwy. And Rex, I'm going to ask that you read this and comment on it, and I'll be right back and comment on it as soon as I get back.
The Average of Life by Gronwy. Hold on to your mediocrity. It's the best thing you've got. Be safe in the average of your life. Keep the strange loves hidden in the bunkers of your dreams. Don't want to be a romantic poet, holding court in a bar, a roaring boy not suited to suburbia. It will only end in tears. In a garret by a pub, a painting never sold, a Chatterton suicide, that's the rub. So watch it all on telly, the sex, the drugs, the cage of rock and roll. Then lock your suburban door on Betjeman's Metroland. Keep you safe, average of your life. And boom, if that's true, I like the slap of this. Keep the strange loves hidden in the bunkers of your dream. Great line. And holding court in a bar, a rolling boy not suited to suburban. I kind of hit on the notion of Bukowski in the moment. Holding court in a bar. I like that. And so watch it all on telly, the sex and drugs, the cage of rock and roll. Kind of hints at the notion of, you know what, you can actually watch it on TV, go out and live life where you can actually meet real people instead of seeing of the ugliness bared. And then lock your suburban door on Betjeman's Metroland. Keep you safe in the average of your life. Kind of hits in the city being maybe the biggest issue in today's world, the large cities where everything is congested and packed into such a severe sardine can that things are bound to bubble over and offer up terminal velocity in ways that most will never understand because they never live in those cities. All right, Pam, what you got?
All right. Well, let's see here. Hold on to your mediocrity. It's the best thing that you've got. That is an interesting opening line. You know, I like to me there's this kind of a noted, I don't know if it's sarcasm or sardonic feel to the whole entire right, to that idea of you might as well just stay average, you know, because, you know, goodness only knows what could happen. You could end up being some romantic, being some romantic poet, a roaring boy not suited to suburbia. It will only end in tears in a garret by a pub. Painting never sold, a Chatterton suicide, that's the rub. So watch it all on telly. To me, it's the whole idea, you know, of that bite that says, you know what, you can be one of two people. You can be those people who get out there and live life to the fullest, that, you know, embrace the spirit of rock and roll. Or you can be the duped masses that, create with those glazed over eyes, watching, doing nothing but watching television. I like that then lock your suburban door at that Benjamin Metro and to keep you safe in the average of your life. And you know, at the end of an average life, you know, yeah, you're safe, but do you actually have good stories to tell? So, you know, just a really intriguing write and very well done.
Well said there, Pam. Thank you. All right, where do we go now?
All right. Well, up next, we did have a caller, but unfortunately they didn't stick around long enough. So maybe they'll call back. And if not, well, all right, I better grab the next right. Let's see. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe, catch a tiger by its toe. All right. Here we go. All right. We have misspelled but never misunderstood by Incubus 2. And it goes like this. I never wanted to be left. I always preferred to be right. Never will I just give up, not even when I'm down. I knew from day one what I had to do to be the three, just not seek fame and recognition in case in doing so lost me. Power brings with it responsibility, and I prefer not to lead when I can just follow others as I have such simple needs. Bread and cheese to eat, milk to drink, al fresco within the clean fresh air, a blanket and a skyline, and your company to share. So follow my thread and never pin your hopes on dreams, for power, wealth, and immortality bring you such troubles, it would seem. End poem.
Great read, Pam. I like to play on the language with this. Because the opposite misspelled as the first, like the deliberate misspelling in here, like that one line, where was it? That you had a little bit of trouble with because it looks confusing. What I had to do three. Rolling that one, plus the it would seem on the back end, and so follow my thread. A great thought is that in order to sew, you have to actually follow the thread, but the thread here also follows on a different thought where Twitter is a notion when you hit on and keep popping out, there's a thread to be seen and sewn, so to speak. So, and then what was another one? That opening, I never wanted to be left. I always preferred to be right. Never will I just give up, not even when I'm down. Clever play on the voice itself. And there is a note. There are simple things, bread and cheese to eat, milk to drink, al fresco with a clean fresh air, a blanket and a skyline, and your company to share. There's a notion of nature in that. And dreams are fine, but if you get a pin on them, there are certain things that that come along with it as power, wealth, and immortality bring you such troubles, it would seem. Yes, especially if you misrepresent or misunderstand the comprehension of what that power, wealth, and immortality offers up to yourself as opposed to offering up to the whole.
Great comment there, Rex. Yeah, I really liked his play with words. The to-do-to did really throw me off, but what threw me off even more was I kept thinking that it was going to say, you know, to be there. And so, because, you know, there was so much play with words with homophones that I thought it was, for some reason it just really didn't register as three, even as I was saying it. But I liked it. I liked the wordplay and the humor. You know, I never wanted to be left. I always preferred to be right. Now, that opening line there really reminds me of the saying that, you know, sometimes it's better, you know, like that whole idea of, you know, yeah, you may have proven yourself right, but what was the cost? You know, you may have won the argument, but did you really win the war? I really liked that the end stanza, how he played with the words the soul spelled S-E-W. You know, so as like I said there, there's the wonderful use of words that sound the same but are spelled different. And also the use of the spelling of the word seem, you know, with which, as you mentioned, connects really well, that whole stanza with you. So follow my thread, bring your troubles, it would seem. Wonderful wordplay. I really thought there was a nice kind of tender touch to the idea of, you know, just that spending that time together out in the fresh air, and really just a great rite and very well done.
Well said. All right. What are we going to do now?
All right. Up next we have, hold on. I seem to be falling a bit behind here, so let me grab the next one. And all right. Ah, here we go. There's a good one for you to read. All right. All right, up next we have Assault and Battery by Time Teller. And Rex, go ahead and give that a read for us, please.
Assault and Battery by Time Teller. I know what I like. Snowy owl upon a night you slide, as if my life has but one gift from heaven. Beneath the stars on moonbeams you ride, quick as silver, or life has stopped to deaden. Now, there was this man, see, he comes up to me, see. Hey, you, we reap what we sow. Yeah, I say. Hey, you, he says again, acts of kindness, that's what it's about, see. I see, I say, and you insist on forcing this attitude upon me. Then is that not assault, I say? I don't need your rewards. I did what I did because I wanted to. A favor for a favor. How old are you, 10? He says again, hey, you. See, it's like this. You have to know how to behave, to be one of us, to fit in, get promoted, climb the social tree, be part of tradition, the establishment. We test, you behave, and if you do as we think is right, then we see you as fitting in. So, you have admitted to assaulting me then? I never asked to be tested. That was someone else's tune. And I clearly said no. Did I not? And why? Did I not? This man, he thinks I'm different. He thinks I think I am better than him and his mate. He thinks his groups and societies have the right answers. His culture is correct and mine wrong. He uses leverage to force me to bend to his attitude, and yet doesn't think that's bullying or wrong. Hey, you, he says, you just don't cut it, do you? Don't see what I'm getting at. We don't seem to be getting anywhere. And with that, the drawbridge was raised and the ark sailed away, leaving me at the shore. Soon after, there was a flash of light. Someone had pushed the button, and then there were many more flashes of light as the deterrents to the first push were pushed in return. And then the dormouse in my pocket said, looks like no one was right after all. And I sat wondering, what up did it all mean? And Paul. All right, Pam.
Great read there, Rex. This is an intriguing write by Time Teller. I find the stanza about the snow owl beautiful, but I'm not quite sure how it fits in. Like, it just seems like some odd, random thought, but it's beautiful. But from there, you know, I see a consistent message of the idea of people who act, have that holier-than-thou attitude, who act like they're better than everyone, and who try to passive-aggressively convince you that they are right and you are wrong. You know, I like how it very much to me, like when he starts out with, you know, he says, hey, you, we reap what we sow. So, yeah, I say, hey, you, he says again, acts of kindness. It just reminds me of people who make themselves seem smarter than they actually are by quipping off cliches. And I like the bite in the line, I don't need your reward. I did what I did because I wanted to, a favor for a favor. How old are you, 10? Just really strong lines there. And excellent use of back and forth. I also like, he thinks his group and societies have the right answers. His culture is correct and mine wrong. He uses leverage to force me to bend to his attitude and yet doesn't think that that's bullying or wrong. You know, it's so funny how people have an idea of what bullying is, and it's always what's not what they're doing. And also the dormouse in his pocket, I thought was a really nice reference to Alice in Wonderland in the Looking Glass. The character of the dormouse, I thought that was really clever there. And, and we don't seem to be getting anywhere. And with that, the drawbridge was raised and the ark sailed away, leaving me at the shore. To me, that's kind of like the thought of sometimes if we don't rethink, we get left behind. Can you imagine that moment when it's a great flood, all the people who regretted not listening to what the crazy guy who built the ark had to say? And the great ending line, and I sat wondering, what the fuck did it all mean? A really great metaphor for how so oftentimes that those storms of life come on us, and we try to find answers within, like how things are going wrong, and it's like, well, there's got to be a reason things are going wrong. We always need there to be reasons, because without reasons, we tend to emotionally fall apart. So just a really great write and very well done.
Well said. I'm going to take that opening stanza as the actuality to the end stanza. Snowy owl upon the night you slide, as if my life had but one gift from heaven. Beneath the stars and moonbeams you ride, quick as silver, all life has stopped. The dead, that is the motif of death, risen. Totally. So it fits the back end of what the fuck is all this about. Well, that is the end of things as they are, because the cultish temerity of those who have all this language that befit everything that goes on, yet there are no real vitals in the language itself. They are empty, thoughtless trollop, which actually is designed for one thing in mind, and that is only to have one point, one view, one serious vigil to anything across the whole of mankind, and that is their purview, and nothing more need be asked nor risen against it. It's about no free thought, no free will, no free speech, no nothing that doesn't walk within their angle of how things should be, as opposed to, hey, you know what? Conversations happen. There should be commonalities, the ground set upon, and also actions which also split them apart, because, you know what? I don't agree with that. You don't agree with what I said. So what? That's the way things are meant to be. That's how you hash out the indifferences and get down to the brass tacks of actually taking care of things on the whole. Compromise.
Absolutely.
All right, what you got?
Well said there, Rex. I really like how you mentioned that, we're never, the whole world isn't always going to see eye to eye. There has to be that variety of opinions, that those differences, and sometimes you just have to, figure out how to work things out around the differences. So, and up next we have, She Was the Light in My Darkness, by Darkened Auras, and it goes like this. I woke up from a dead sleep, a memory brought to light, a realization came to me that something wasn't right. My world's been full of darkness, bathed in a pit inside my head. I've been stuck back in the 90s since my grandma's been dead. Memories I have so fond were when she was alive. Have I made up new ones in order to survive? After all, she was the light that ate away the dark. When she died, it overtook me, leaving a lasting mark. End poem.
Great read, Pam. The flowiness is wonderful and speaks in the ease of thought offered up. Memories I have so fond were when she was alive. Have I made up new ones in order to survive? It kind of hits the notion of a twixt thoughts in the memory bank that kind of sticks itself hard as you remember something, but did it occur earlier than I actually remember it? Have I misremembered something because of her leaving holds such a profound note in my mind and heart that I've mixed something in between? I like that thought. How about you?
Yeah, you know, I have to agree with you that there was a really important message within the poem of wondering what you've missed being due to, focused on death. But, you know, which it's understandable because, you know, when you have someone like that, like, first of all, it's a beautiful heartfelt tribute to her grandmother, to her grandmother's memory. And the idea of how important this woman was in her life. And when you have somebody who's that important, especially as a young person, you know, as a child, and they leave, they die, you know, you just, it hurts. And sometimes it's difficult for that not to be the only thing that you're focused on. Now, I too am stuck in the 90s. However, that has to do with my music taste. So
that's kind of what they call the Mandela effect. You remember something so totally, yet it doesn't fit the motif because it doesn't fit the year and the angle that you do remember because the offset is that happened 6 months prior, but I'm talking about 6 months future.
That's really good point there. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, and it's interesting how our memories play games and tricks with us. Like, sometimes there are people who pass away, and the farther it is away from the death, the harder it is to remember things about them. And there's almost this idea of making people who have passed away into saints, when they were just as flawed as anybody else. I do like where she says, have I made up new ones in order to survive? You know, the idea of creating those memories or wondering, as you said, am I living my life to the fullest? And in all honesty, I think when any of our loved ones pass on, what they would want the most is for us to not grieve for the rest of our lives. They would want us to see us going forth, living and loving and, being the person we want to be. And I'm quite certain her grandmother is looking down on her and very proud of her for her poetry because, this is a beautiful and emotive write. And I really like that end line, leaving a lasting mark. And I like that she didn't end it with a period, but with the mark that means a continuation, with the idea that she knows that you know, these, there are more of these thoughts to be continued, not necessarily maybe to be written down, but, you know, within her own heart and perhaps to be shared. You know, so beautifully written and very well done.
All right. Where are we going next?
So was the Mandela effect named after the scientist or the political leader?
Yeah, the political. It's the thought to understanding something in the moment, but it didn't occur, so to speak. It was never real or remembered. Totally wrong.
Okay. Actually, I don't think Mandela, who was the guy who was the scientist that discovered the, like raised the pea plants?
The what?
And remember, he was a biologist. He was a lot of the, what is it called when you inherit certain traits? Genetics. He was the father of genetics. Who was the father of genetics? Oh, I'm going to have to look it up. Not this moment.
Mendelssohn?
I think that was it. Yeah. Yeah, I just remember learning about him way back in junior high.
Gregor Mendel.
That was it. Gregor Mendel, yep. That was it. They actually found out later, though, that some of his discoveries weren't exactly on point. However, so many of his work, and plus the fact that, you know, no scientist is going to be 100% right, you know, but he definitely paved the way for other people who study genealogy in the scientific form. Yeah. But anyways, and up next we have Derailed by S. Sharp. And Rex, go ahead and give that a read for us, please.
Derailed by S. Sharp. Parallel lines in life cross me, intersect me, lying in the hospital with solid tone sounding. Me, in different directions, on different lights and times, layers and realms, past regret, gone, past change, existence change. Confused. Who are these people? What do you mean my mother died when I was a child? She is here with me by my bedside crying. You are not my wife. I have never met you. Wait. You were the girl from Jimmy's that night. The lines in my life crisscross, double over like me now in confusion, disbelief. This is me. That is me. The same person following switching one parallel track and pump. All right, what you got for that?
I really like this. I really enjoy S. Sharp's poetry. I actually have a poem titled Derailed. Huh, funny. But I like that he opens up with parallel lines in life cross me, intersect me. There's two thoughts I get from this poem in general, and I think either or could be right. First of all, I get thoughts of Alzheimer's, where people don't recognize, you know, they don't have the short-term memory, they have the long-term memory, so they can see back into their like childhood, young adulthood, but not in the here and now. I also it kind of has almost a sci-fi feel to it, to the whole idea that what would happen if in life we just took one slightly different turn, jumped one single rail, you know, and what like the whole butterfly effect thing, you know, like what that little difference, what would our life have become, you know? I think my absolute biggest regret was I actually had a cousin who invited me to go live in Germany, and I turned it down. Well, mainly because she invited me because she needed somebody to help her watch her kids, to be a nanny, and I didn't want to be a nanny. But, you know, honestly, I kind of wish I had, just to have had that experience. But I really feel like the whole Alzheimer thing, the dementia thing works really well, too, the idea of laying in the hospital bed, laying in the nursing home bed, and not recognizing your loved ones. I was particularly moved by the words, the lines of my life crisscross double over like me now in confusion, disbelief. This is me, that is me, the same person following, switching once parallel tracks. There's a real sense of loss of self within those lines. I thought it was beautifully written and very well done.
All right, I can see the Alzheimer's, but I don't agree on that angle, especially with that first stanza, lying in the hospital with solid tone sounding. That means death. And the everything else, the confusion, the relevancy of different lives and times, the layers and realms, past, scripts, gone, past, changed, existence changed, kind of hints on the notion of multiple parallel universes all converging in the moment, because you die in one, the thought he's offering up is you're dying across multiple universal planes at the same time. So in that convergence, you're confused because all of the lives that you have lived or could possibly have lived based on those multi-universes offer up a difference all coming together. So the confusion sets in, and they are very different because what you do here does not reflect it was what happening in the next one or the one after that or the one after that on down the line. So the confusion, the double, the crisscross double over like me now in confusion and disbelief. This is me, that is me, the same person following, switching once parallel tracks. They used to run together as a pure configuration because the timelines were different. Now that the timeline is broken because death walked across all of them, they have converged.
I like that thought. I like that. Yeah. And it's interesting because there have actually, like, I remember back when we used to have what was that show that Luna did? Myths and Legends. Yes. The idea of a parallel universes or other dimensions, there's actually been cases. There was one case. I watched a few fascinating videos on that subject and did some reading because we had a show on that. There was one instance where a woman watched her husband walk into a field, an open field, because he was going to go work, plow the field, work the farm, and just disappear. And there were times that people could actually hear his voice when they stood in that spot. And there wasn't anything for him to disappear into. He didn't walk into the woods. He walked into an open field and disappeared.
Well, that was a story written by, I forget his name, back in the 1880s. He was in the Civil War. He got wounded in the head, and he became the first kind of science fiction writer moving forward out of the late 1800s into the 20th century. I can't remember his name at the moment. But he wrote that story, and he wrote another one, The Thing That Happened at Owl
story,
Creek.
It was a true event, but no, I get what you're saying. That is a story, too. You're right.
But he also wrote that the thing at Owl Creek.
Which one was that?
Where somebody got hung off a bridge. There was a whole storyline behind it.
Oh, yes, I think I know what you're talking about. I can't think of the name either, but I've seen it before. Is it this? there's this one short story that it's just, and it might be the same one, where the whole story is someone remembering their life. And you,
yeah, Ambrose Bierce.
Yes, that's it. That's it.
He also
yeah.
wrote that Field and, one. It was kind of a science fiction note at the time of walking in the fields and then disappearing, yet the voices could still be heard.
Interesting. That one story that it would just took, the whole story took place with the hanging, like the split second between the release and you know the snap of the neck, that the whole story took place within that time period. Like it was all the thoughts rushing to the guy's head just before his death. That was always a fascinating story. But no, I think because there are actually, and I'm not saying that's a true story for sure. For all I know, the husband ran off and slept with his younger mistress, and the wife made that story up because she didn't want to admit that her husband left her. So I can't say for sure it's a true story, but I do know that while Ambrose Bierce wrote that a story about that incident, like you said, there have also been real life incidences where people have claimed to, go through or see people like completely disappear out of the blue. So, but you know, what they say, there's always a little truth in every fiction and a little fiction in every truth. Well, I don't know if anyone says that, but they do. What's that?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. And
His was called The Difficulty of Crossing a Field.
Okay, cool. I'm going to have to actually read that story. I the other story of his I've read, I liked, so I'm definitely going to have to check that one out, too. That'll be worth checking out. Another author that I want to check out, I actually want to do a dark show on her, is Gertrude Barrows Bennett. She was considered the mother of science fiction horror.
Okay. Her name's certainly a mouthful.
Right? Exactly. And, all right. I'll go ahead and mosey us on to the next right. All right. Up next, we have Potatoes by Babbler. And it goes like this. The crunch of a potato, raw and sprinkled with salt, satisfied my ears. Thousands of years of heritage wrapped in a tuber, pale starches tumbling down to my shriveled belly. The same tuber that rotted, blackened by blight, wasn't there for the teeth for my Green Isle ancestors, emaciated bodies littering the countryside, and they blame the potato. Brown root ripped from the soil, boiled into soft yellow mounds, mixed with butter, the culprit of a massacre, butter and milk flowing freely to the island next door, more than before the lumper went sour, elongating the belt of the English. I could point a finger, those modern, fine, suited men sitting in the same seat for over 30 years, collecting lifelong pensions and voting for their own raises, in the name of service, pulling all but this raw potato from my tiny mouth. My 9-year-old body huddles unshodden on a dirty stoop, but my finger is busy picking at blind eyes. 1,000 years and still the same story. 1,000,000 years and the world will still turn unbothered by small potatoes. End poem.
Great read, Pam. Well, I'd say shrewd and tart sarcasm. Bends from one direction almost 200 years ago to that which is now the single point. There is such an ease and flame. Was it collecting lifelong pensions and voting for their own raises in name of service? Pulling all but this raw potato from my tiny mouth, my 9-year-old body huddles unshodden on a dirty stoop. Well, as a reflection of of today, but my finger is busy picking at blind eyes. Potato might have many eyes, yet it does not see that which is done to it, for it, and because of it. What you got?
I like that, Rex, and you're right. There is a bite of sarcasm within this. I really like, she's very dexterously juggles the different time periods. Like, she draws our attention into the here and now, and then she draws our attention back to her personal history, her childhood, but also a look at her ancestors, and not just her ancestors, but the idea of the huddled masses in general, the idea of, all of those who were pushed from their homeland or had to leave their homeland to find something better. I liked the play on words with butter and milk flowing freely, like that whole idea of the land of milk and honey. I also like that she points out that how quickly people are to point fingers, the idea of, that I really liked the hard-hitting line of collecting the lifelong pensions and voting for their own raises in the name of service, pulling all but this raw potato from my tiny mouth. And I like that while it's a personal right, it's also a right that speaks for the idea of all hungry children, all starving and, not people who just want to be healthy and happy. I also really liked that near the end where she played on words with the idea of, but my finger is busy picking at blind eyes. First of all, you get the imagery, obviously, of picking away the eyes of the potato in order to be able to eat it. But also that idea of how, as a poet or as anyone with a voice, you have the opportunity to show people a bit of a truth that they don't see. And that ending was clever. Unbothered by small potatoes. Too many times, people don't see the full picture, it's interesting. Now, the Irish potato famine, wasn't that because they depended too much on that one crop?
It was a staple that came that went through a serious blight, which ruined the crops and led to starvation. But yeah, it was a staple, just like leeks and parsley and basil and barley as part of the food chain, the natural food chain, because it was such a wealthy crop.
Well, a lot of, then that's That's interesting. And, you know, because what has I've noticed, I think this has happened before, is a lot of times, it's kind of like that saying, putting all your eggs in one basket, is a lot of times when a state or a country depends too much on one resource, especially in farming. Like in farming, if I remember right, you're supposed to rotate with the planting. It's interesting to me, the whole idea of how that disease of the potatoes that just really how it affected a whole nation and changed the course of history. I mean, can you imagine how many people might have actually stayed in Ireland had different
life? Well, about
life.
2 million people left.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
it wasn't just limited to that. It hit Europe as a whole, but Ireland was the most affected.
Really?
I mean, a million people died as a result.
Wow.
And it was in the west and the south of Ireland that were affected the most. In fact, it was like they had, I think it was 25% of Ireland left because of the blight itself. And it did cause other wars as well. And there were some revolutions that occurred along those lines because the potatoes were a common staple of the lower classes of the day because it was such a prominent bit of the food chain.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah. I guess, you just hear, I always heard about it being, like, affecting the Irish. I never realized that it affected other countries, too. So, interesting. Learn something new. Very cool. All right. And let's see what we got next. All right. Up next, we have Fight by Thomas B. And Rex, go ahead and give that a read.
Fight by Thomas B. The truth about war. It is not fair. It does not care who dies. Winning is for history to decide. Bullets don't care what they hit. Death is the only way out. Innocence is a death warrant. Given our weapons of mass destruction, we can no longer talk about winning, only how do we survive, when do we know it's over? What's left that is worth having? Wring your hands, cry over the body bags, sacrifice, sacrifice. Every family must be ready to start over. War is never an arena of glory, it is only a theater of death. We have come to a place where we cannot afford our temper tantrums, our need to amass more than the guy next door. The fight. Cheer the underdog. Sing the fight song has become mechanized. If war doesn't work, gods do not decide outcomes. What does it mean to be a man? Do we understand how to be human? Want to fight about it? And boom, what do you got?
All right. Well, first of all, great read there. I like a good one-word title, and I like an end line with bite with the question you want to fight about. I like, and I think he makes some really great points here, you know, and especially like right opening up right away, the truth about war, it is not fair. It does not care who dies. Winning is for history to decide. Bullets don't care what they hit. Death is the only way out. Innocence is a death warrant. You know, there's that whole idea that, to me, of the idea that we have to remember that war is basically a machine. It is, you know, while the individuals involved may have emotions, war itself is emotionless. What's left is worth having. We have come to a place where we cannot afford our temper tantrums, our need to amass more than the guy next door. The fight, cheer the underdog, sing the fight song has become mechanized. I like how it says, you know, there are battles, you know, to me that says there are battles worth fighting. There, you know, there are things that should be fought for, but there are things, there are arguments just not worth having. That, you know, too oftentimes, and it also speaks to me that too oftentimes we really don't necessarily understand what it means to the idea of patriotism. That, you know, that if we become simply followers of every other cheerleader rather than feeling something in our heart. And I like the idea that, you know, if we don't fight for what we believe in, if we don't fight for the important things, if we just stand by and let everything be taken from us, that means we have no say over our own life. So I really thought this was a powerful and thought-provoking write and very well done.
Absolutely. We have come to a place where we cannot afford our temper tantrums, our need to amass more than the guy next. What is deliberate? It walks in the arts of politics, and those who reap the benefit on both sides. Because if you think people who manufacture are not selling to the other side, you're seriously wrong and you're seriously misguided. Because banks lend to both sides, they get money from both sides. Weapons manufacturers sell to both sides, they reap the benefits from both sides, and they never get broken. They don't have to sit around and watch what happened, because they are on far off shores enjoying the money they have collected. And when you start breaking down arenas and countries and more places because denying them their field in the world trade and all that, you know what? When they start running out of goods to meet supply and feed their own people, they will make a move to take someone else. And then that's where the big boys come in and strip everything away from everybody around that arena, but most importantly, from the loser, because they take reparations then, and everything that was in that country is then offloaded. Money.
Absolutely. But you know, I like that you touched on the idea of war for profit and how
it's always been
for
profit. Wars get started in the name of profit. Wars get started with
false
flags to drag someone in because the money men need more money, the manufacturers need more sales, and someone needs to show superiority in the moment.
Sad but true. Absolutely. Well said there, Rex.
Some of the richest people on the world are not whom you think. They're not the swords. Yeah, they're rich, but they are not the richest people in the world. They are quite rich. Something like I think $6 trillion worth of wealth. But there are some serious megalomaniacs who own a whole lot more than just $6 trillion worth of wealth in their coffers. There are actually people who own probably twice, well, not people, groups that own three times that in their coffers. And it's real wealth like gold, silver, platinum, property, art. And that comes from the benefit of being on the back end. oh, I can loan you this and I can loan you that. I can make you this. I can make you that. And yes, then they take everything they want afterwards.
Mm-hmm. And of course, they're always busy pointing out everybody else's, you know, money and while meantime hiding their own behind their back. So, absolutely.
Well, those are the people you never hear about. Why? Because nobody is allowed. They're like Voldemort. You're not allowed to say their names in public.
Yep. Exactly. Exactly. All right. Well, great conversation there, Rex. I got to say, you always have some interesting tidbits and stuff that you know. So, all right. But I'm going to go ahead and bring us on to the next right, which is An Indifferent Resplendence by Kolap. And it goes like this. Through the parallel and intersected lattice of palm fronds as they fan the light that lands and bounce off the dark green tarp and ricochet, then flow in a veil-like glow unto all that is found beneath it, beads of light that shatter into sparkles, flooding my tiny corner of the universe in complete indifference, equanimity in its resplendence. It is what it is in our bewilderment. We coin a name, a state of grace, but the palm tree exists nonetheless, with or without our judgment. It fulfills an infinitesimal part of its role in the greater canvas, whose meaning escapes what we thinking mortals are capable to grasp. The eureka twinkle, the infractions of a second, the latter resorbs into the automated movement of a day. End poem.
Great read, Pam. I like that. I like that thought with the title, An Indifferent Resplendence, because it begs to be drawn out. And actually, Kolap did that. Through the parallel and intersected lattice of palm fronds as they span the light that lands and bounce off the dark green tarp and ricochet and flow in a veil-like glow. There is a notice in detail for the small things that offer up a sense of background balance, and they are indifferent in the moment, but they hold a difference within that moment because they are set center stage as that grounding fit to the horror you might actually find beneath it next. Onto all that is found beneath it, beads of light that shatter into sparkles, flooding my tiny corner of the universe with least indifference in quantity and its resplendence. You don't really take notice of those little nuances that some filmmakers use really quite well. Like, take that scene in Apocalypse Now where Martin Sheen is lying on the bed. Yet what you get is him laying there all decked out, but you get the fan above rotating, swirling that hot air, and you get that even though you might not see it, you notice it. It's humid, it's rank, it's hard-edged, and it depicts something that most don't notice in the moment, but it's still there. It sets the stage between the thought and what is going on, especially when he starts talking in his mind, eye, so to speak, about what he's going on, what he's been told to do, what next he is going to do. So those little nuanced moments, you take notice because they stand out. Because they hold a perfect point in time that you can refer back to, even though you won't reflect on the palm or the sand itself, but you reflect to the images that stand out past that because they hold that moment in your mind's eye. All right, what you got?
I like that. I like I did have a little trouble hearing all your whole comment because I was getting like these bursts of, I don't know, just fading in and out. But first of all, the quote she chose to write to was, I think, the most chosen one, the most popular one, and that was, the most terrifying fact about the universe is not that it is hostile, but that it is indifferent. I really liked the opening lines, and what I find interesting about that is because I can relate to it despite the fact that we grew up in two different worlds. While I've never laid under or stood underneath a palm tree and looked up, I've laid under or stood underneath, you know, oak trees, maple trees, and watched the way, you know, as the sunlight shines through and, you know, there's this play of shadow and light within the movements of the leaves that it is absolutely fascinating. And it has such a meditative feel to it. But and then I like how she uses the palm tree as an extended metaphor for the representation of the universe, you know, and how the universe will keep on going. Life will keep on going. The earth will keep going. The palm tree exists, and it exists without judgment. You know, and I like that, those lines in particular. But the palm tree exists nonetheless, with or without our judgments. It fulfills an infinitesimal part of its role in the greater canvas, whose meaning escapes what we thinking mortals are capable to grasp. You know, the whole idea that that despite all of our intelligence, there's so much about life that and about the world that we are unable to fathom. It's 'cause too oftentimes we're not able to see beyond ourselves. Oh man, I can't remember what I was. Shoot, well, I just lost the thought in the middle of a thought. I thought this was a wonderful representation of the palm tree as the universe itself. Oh yeah, fun fact, and you probably already know this, but more people are killed by falling coconuts per year than by sharks.
Well, the same could be said for lightning strikes.
Yes, lightning strikes, falling coconuts. And cows. Apparently, I read this. I don't know if it's true or not, but I like to think it's true because it's a fun fact. More people are killed by cows than by sharks.
Well, if you're stupid enough to try kicking and you get kicked, well, I'd say you're landing in a pile of liquid shit.
Absolutely.
Oh, patchy cake smeared on your face. How do you look? Oh, such a disgrace.
Yeah, people can be pretty dumb when it comes to cows. Well, and that's part of the difference. Like, you never hear of people doing shark tipping. I mean, it could be a thing in Australia. It sounds like, you know, that sounds like something Australians would do. You know, I think it's probably
I doubt that, considering they got great whites in Sydney Harbor.
Oh, well, aren't there sharks in Australia, near Australia?
Yes.
Like near the reefs?
Yeah, they got plenty of reef sharks, but they also got great whites that like to troll and hunt around Sydney.
Okay. Oh, I misunderstood. Okay. Right? Yeah. No, I don't. Actually, I'm pretty sure there is no, but there are people who will tip cows. There are not many people I can imagine that would tip sharks.
Yes. Let's go get shit-faced and tip cows until you find yourself actually shit-faced.
The funny thing is, I actually have spent most of my life in Wisconsin and never knew anybody who tipped a cow. I'm almost certain that is actually just a, you know, like one of those urban legends, like one of those things that people make up about Wisconsin. either that or I just wasn't cool enough to be invited to the cow tipping parties. So.
Okay, well.
I didn't.
Well, it does. Hey, why go cow tipping? Hey, we can do the, what do they call it? We can do the discus at barbecues with cow patties.
Oh, my gosh, right? Yeah, I got all kinds of fun to be had with cow patties. All right, we better try to get in a couple more rights at least. Next up, we have People of Ice by T. Michelle. And Rex, go ahead and give that a read for us, please.
People of Ice by T. Michelle. Gold pours the flames, pelt the thin glass of a shrunk conscience. Painkillers resurrecting raindrops of little stars to the icy world of men among withering red roots. It maddened them, their heaps of frozen monstrous strains dividing behind a prickly fence where prejudice bears its teeth on both sides. Their hatred formed a puddle of murky yogurt, separating its thick chunks to show scattered hedgerows of unsheared pine and potted peas. And they, mewling over a glossary of smoke, returning to a silver of fading off-white like an uncut twilight, were furious with that unwanted thing of beauty and truth. From my own orchard, I could sense the eruption of pale waves in knitted tamarind wool melting into a pool of liquid fire, and I had never been so smitten with anything as I was with their tangled veins so alive. Bleeding out leaflets of pelargonium, the musky notes of overpowering hummock herbs dissolving an iced sea of heartbeats. I grew fat until the ripples burst in my marrow, spreading a torrent of ache that coughed up an anthill of porcelain grains. Fragile emotions emptied of their sickening misrepresentation, a patty whose malady clung like a talisman. And Paul.
Great reader.
Well, what you got?
Oh, let's see. Well, she wrote to the quote, "I do not always know what I want, but I do know what I don't want." I liked the direction she took this in. The general thought I get from it is the idea of that competitive nature that we have with our neighbors to the point, and not only, but not just competitive, like not a healthy competitive, but the idea of how we perceive those who are different than us with hatred. I really liked the opening of gold pours of flame, pelt the thin glass of a shrunk conscience. You know, that kind of makes me think of the whole phrase, you know, people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. And I like the phrase shrunk conscience and the whole idea that as more and more hate festers within us, it shrinks our ability to actually feel for people. I also, oh my gosh, I have the whole image of the murky yogurt separating its thick chunks to show scattered head growth. That is, I have never seen anybody use, you know, chunky yogurt as a metaphor, and it really works well because it is extremely visceral. It is extremely ugly, and it's the representation of something that was meant to be nourishment, was meant to be good, and has fallen apart. I also really like weeding out leaflets of pelargonium, the musky notes of overpowering hummock herbs dissolving in ice sea of heartbeats. I grew fat until the ripples burst in my marrow. You know, I get this idea almost of wanting to poison someone, like maybe not literally, but this idea of, but but wanting to poison them and ending up poisoning yourself, as if being poisoned by your own mind, by your own thoughts. Just a really intriguing write. As always, she just has a wonderful way with imagery and metaphors, and it's very well done.
Well said. I think that shrunk conscience holds the Epicurean delight in the moment. Shrunk conscience. People willing to do anything and everything to get what they want, and hence a prickly fence where prejudice bears its teeth on both sides. The hatred formed a puddle of murky yogurt, murky water, the sourness and that sort, and the thick chunks hit on the note of regurgitation and the mewling because all of a sudden the shining of light and truth holds its beauteous note in the moment. And then the turn to my own orchard, I can sense the eruption of pale waves, knitted tamarind wool melting into a pool of liquid fire. There's a sense of almost rebirth. And I'd never been so smitten with anything as I was with their tangled veins so alive. The notion of breathing freely in the moment, bleeding out leaflets of pelargonium. I like that. Pelargonium. Flowers, they're perennials. Blooming. There's a few hundred varieties that roll into that sort of pelargonium, where the beauty comes alive in the moment. And the thought of opening up that angle, where it's just those hummock herbs dissolving a nice sea of heartbeats, and the thought of growing fat on that notion of truth bared to offer up the beauty in the fact that truth should be winning a day past the abhorrent thought of all the rippling garbage that rolls downhill. And again, in that fragile emotion emptied of this sickening misrepresentation, a Patty whose malady clung like a talisman, there is that note of it. Yes, got to cough up the garbage so you can actually breathe once more past the abhorrent churning of that murky yogurt, its chunk.
Absolutely.
All right. We got time for one more.
Oh, for sure, for sure. Up next, we have Between You and Me by Kasia F., and it goes like this. Roses bloom, recent, I feel, the perfume of a mystic reminds me of your scent, the open arms to welcome my hungry touch in sublime ways. I sway as you dance, heart pulsates, lips ignite, as my heart lost in rhythm to the drunkenness of emotion. I have dreamed about your fingers in my hair, slowly teasing each strand, my eyes closed. I feel you as I tremble. I knew we belong, stories told, ancient pyramids stand, rocks in the sand, oceans deep, all corners. I felt you as you danced, velvet of love swims in my core. I remember your touch, delicate, soft music to my heart. Strokes of divinity made me shake. I could not behold smell of your hair, lines in bloom, hair golden brown circled, your face to accent the flow of golden glow of your skin. I was lost amongst the perfume of your being. Flow of love lingered amongst the space between you and me. End poem.
Great read, Pam. Although this hits on the thought of, well, between you and me, obviously, the thought between two, it does walk a nice spiritual note to nature. Roses bloom, recent. I feel the perfume of a mystic. That hits on the notion of a gorgeous scent from a rose. I like that. And then offering that thought of passing the notion with the idea of nature itself into reminds me of your scent, the open arms to welcome a hungry touch, which also kind of alludes right back to the rose again. There's such a delicate, soft, satin feel when touching the rose and smelling the rose. And then in sublime way, I sway as you dance, heart pulsates, lips ignite, as my heart lost in rhythm to the drunkenness of emotion. Again, a point to the rose, but walking in lines of sensual notes, but also walking through that angle of spirituality, stories told, ancient pyramids stand, rocks in the sand, longevity in the thought itself. And what are you got?
I like that. I like that because you're definitely right. While there's a romantic feel to this, there is also a spiritual. And she wrote to the prompt, the truth of a thing is in the feel of it, not the think of it. And she touched on that very well with the whole idea of emotions felt. And it's not just about, you know, the physical touch, but rather that sense of connection, that sense of connection between people, that sense of connection between nature and people. I have dreamed about your fingers in my hair, slowly teasing each strand, my eyes closed, I feel you. You know, I like how that brings to me the idea of the wind, you know, blowing through someone's hair. I also like that this has that delicate sensuality to it, and the idea of remembering something, remembering someone. I like that she brings in the imagery of the lilies in bloom. You know, it has such a wonderful feeling of those perfect spring and summer days, and you can smell the ocean breeze, you can smell the lilies, you can smell that lingering of perfume. And I like that she brought up so many different things that have to do with scent, because, you know, scent is so strongly connected to memory, and memory is so strongly connected to scent. So I thought this was beautifully written and very well done, and I hope we get to see more poetry from her on our shows. So excellent show tonight, Rex.
Yes, something a little different with Stanley. And no droogs. No one hit on the droogs.
Yep. So true. And I hope people will make sure to check out contests for upcoming Late Night Poets shows and, of course, topic boards. There's always something to inspire.
Yes.
Yep. Join us tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time, for Twisted Tuesdays with the Twisted Sisters.
And their
all right.
Twisted Bloody Thoughts.
Exactly. And who knows, maybe a Twisted Mister or two with some Twisted Thoughts. All right. Good night, Rex.
Great show, Pam. Thank you very much. Randy, thank you for stopping in. And Stelina on the board, thank you very much. And we'll do this again come next Tuesday morning. Good night, all.